This is The Agenda. Local newsmakers, community leaders, and people in our valley making a difference. Here's your host, Dave Bernstein.
All right, on the program today, we have State Senator Brad Hawkins and a periodic legislative update through the session. So today's the day is Senator Hawkins. Thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Good afternoon, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Well, ordinarily you are over in Olympia, but during this legislative session, they've got pretty much all the members kind of working from home virtually. So you're maybe not totally out of earshot. And so I just real quickly before we got started, wanted to get your impression or reaction to the news that just came out this morning. The Apple Blossom Festival is marching on.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. You know, I think last year was the first year in its 100 or so plus history that we had to cancel the parade. And so I'm excited to have the parade again this year. I guess if it's going to be in towards the middle of summer, it might be a little warmer, but I think we'll all look forward to it. You know, during the Apple Blossom Parade, sometimes it's hit and miss. Sometimes it's sunny and you're out there in t-shirts and shorts and enjoying the food fair and all those things. But other times, you know, the rain comes in and everything. So maybe pushing it out a month or two might make for some really nicer weather. So I'm really looking forward to it. I think that's an opportunity to kind of help put the pandemic behind us and look forward to getting back to normal. And I think we're all looking forward to that.
Yeah, June 3rd through 13th, Darcy Christofferson, the Apple Blossom Festival administrator, said after meeting with the Shalon-Douglas Health District, they felt it would be safe to march on. They're going to have, just hitting some of the bullet points here, food fair, beer garden, entertainment in Memorial Park, the carnival, Pepsi-Cola Youth Day, Arts and Crafts Fair, and a Stamilt and Kais Fiber Community Parade, I think all rolled into one on June the 12th. So all of the big key events in a 10-day festival, June 3rd through the 13th, of course, on March 22nd. So a week from yesterday, we moved to Phase 3 statewide. So we had Jason Mercier from the Washington Policy Center on last week. And he said still no meaningful discussion on executive powers reform. And of course, the legislative majority needs to take the lead on that. And he was saying that there's still time to do that. Have you heard any other inklings on any advancement of that effort?
Well, there's still plenty of time to do it, whether the legislative majorities in the House and Senate and the governor want to see that done, I don't know. And I think the fact that it hasn't been advanced at all this year is an indication of what their position. I did co-sponsor a bill to help reform the executive powers. I actually do support executive powers both at the state level and at the federal level. So I think we have to be thoughtful and not necessarily wipe all these away. But for example, one of the bill that I signed on to as a co-sponsor that I do believe would be very helpful for our state and would have been helpful a year or so ago prior to this pandemic is that if the governor, any governor, Governor Inslee or his successor, whoever that may be, wants to extend an emergency proclamation beyond 30 days or beyond 45 days, then the governor would need to call in a special session or get the legislature's approval to do that. And I think that's reasonable. Now, we could, you know, split hairs on do we want to go 30 days or 45 days or would we want to allow the governor to have one additional reauthorization of an emergency proclamation for an additional 30 days and then bring everybody back. You know, really any variation of that is something I would support. I don't want us to overthink it, but I think what we definitely don't want, and I don't believe what our founders intended, was that for a chief executive like our governor to be able to just issue executive order after executive order that essentially becomes a continuous stream of temporary, in quotes, actions. So I would really like to see some reforms for our emergency powers. whether the governor would sign those into law, I think, would remain the question.
Well, to move on from that topic, the takeaway from the interview that I had last week was we are ranked, according to a study, bottom four states in that category, and other states that where there is again same party control of their House and Senate chambers and their governor's mansion. Even those states are taking that action and trying to get at least their legislators to have a participation representing the people. So,
right, and it was interesting last year. You know, we ended the legislative session approximately the time when the COVID pandemic was just beginning. And so just by coincidence and scheduling and the fact that we're a legislature that only meets for part of the year, the governor had many, many months, almost a year, of being able to do these executive actions for that long. And so it was just sort of for people who want a reform on emergency powers like I do, it was just a perfect storm scenario with the COVID pandemic and when it occurred and when we were no longer in session and couldn't call ourselves back into session without the governor's support. So it was very interesting and frustrating.
Well, we're going to ask about and get some updates on a number of the bills that you have been sponsored or a part of. But before we get to that, I want to ask a little bit about. First off, I think we're about to get another revenue forecast, and we've also are about to get $15 billion in stimulus funds out of the American Recovery Act, or the COVID relief bill, the $1.9 trillion. And of that $15 billion, I understand, coming to our state, budget writers get to stipulate where about a third of that goes, maybe a fourth of it, roughly $4.25 billion. And the Senate Freedom Caucus had a little meeting this morning and kind of identified what they think the priorities should be. So let me ask you, what do you think some of the priorities should be for roughly $4 billion that's coming as a part of the $1.9 trillion being distributed to the states?
Well, the short answer is I'd love to see some targeted and widespread small business relief to help our small businesses. They are the job creators in our state. They are the ones who help employ people, help put food on the table for many families. They have been significantly impacted throughout this pandemic, even despite some of these pretty generous federal relief efforts. But I really think we need to make sure that our small businesses, especially those that are really still struggling right now as we look to continue to reopen the economy, we want to make sure they are not only protected, we want to make sure they're in a position to succeed in the future. Because if we can continue to allow them to do what they do well, which is help grow our economy and employ people, then our state will have the revenue it needs through sales taxes and existing business and occupation taxes and other existing taxes without the need to raise more taxes to fund government. So we really need to focus everything we can, I think, on the economy. Also, I really think we have a growing mental health challenge throughout our state and probably throughout our country, particularly the younger people that have been without their friends and in isolation from school. So I think they have some continued and now expanded, unfortunately, mental health challenges in our state. So my thought would be make an effort on those two fronts. But there are a lot of other things we can do in terms of education, learning, recovery, and other things. Unfortunately, the way some of those federal congressional packages are put together, the money comes flowing through the states and is apportioned out through our state governments to locals, but we don't have as much flexibility, as you mentioned, on exactly how to spend those funds. Sometimes we do have some of those opportunities, and personally, I think if there is a revenue shortfall, or there was, maybe we don't need to fully utilize our rainy days fund. Maybe we certainly don't need to raise taxes at this time to fund more government because we have the backfilled revenue from the federal government. So those are the sort of things that I'd like to use the funding for, to balance the budget without new taxes, to shore up support for small businesses, and to help with mental health and educational supports. But I have a feeling that that will be vigorously debated, and there will be plenty of proponents to still raise taxes in Olympia and grow our government.
Now, I think it was a weekend ago, there was the 25-24 vote in the state Senate on the capital gains tax that is, in any other state, they would call that an income tax, and they're calling it an excise tax here. And in the Senate, I know you guys got an amendment on that does allow for a vote of the referendum to allow the public to say no, we don't want this if it ultimately is passed.
Right.
But it's going back to the House now, and we had heard that may get put back into it, which if it gets changed at all, comes back to the Senate. What do you think of the prospects when it comes back to the Senate and is changed getting the same vote again with this emergency clause put back in, or how can you handicap that for us?
Well, it's a can of worms, Dave, but you're right. It is an income tax. I refer to it as the capital gains income tax because the IRS, the Federal Internal Revenue Service, characterizes the capital gains as income. The state Supreme Court has long held that income is property, and property has to be taxed uniformly. So we are treating it as an income tax, and it's definitely not a reform, by the way. And I'll get to that. But to answer your question, the proponents of this income tax added an emergency clause onto the original bill, which normally bills after they're signed by the governor take 90 days, 3 months, in order to actually become law. Well, with an emergency clause, it says this is an absolute emergency, it has to be implemented right away, and if the governor signs it, boom, the next day it becomes law. Well, with an emergency clause, there isn't the time period to actually round up the signatures for a citizens' referendum, which is one of the checks and balances that we have, much like we did with the comprehensive sex education. That went to a referendum. Referendums are similar to statewide initiatives in the sense that all statewide voters get a chance to weigh in on it up or down, but it's a little different than initiative because it didn't originate as an idea from citizens. It came through the legislative process, but we could put a check on it. Well, fortunately, we were successful in the Senate at not necessarily stopping the capital gains income tax by passing through the Senate. That passed the Senate by a 25-24 majority victory. But we were successful at stripping out that emergency clause from the bill. So when it was sent over to the House, it would still be subject to a referendum. Now, if the House puts that back in, the bill will come back over to the Senate, as you mentioned, for another floor fight, which it was about 4 hours on that capital gains debate. But the real issue that I see with this particular tax is it's not a reform. It's simply a new tax. A new tax at a time when we were just talking about all the massive amounts of federal revenue that we're likely receiving in our state, and other states are as well. So we do have a very regressive tax system in our state, and I will acknowledge that. And what that means is that the lower income portions of the population pay a disproportionately higher amount of their income as taxes, and that's due primarily to our state's reliance on the sales tax. We do have business taxes. We have some other small amount of the property taxes, although the property taxes are mostly local options. But mostly the sales tax. Well, it's not as if proponents of this capital gains income tax were saying, hey, let's bring in this capital gains income tax, but let's correspondingly reduce and lower these regressive taxes. No, that's not what they did, Dave. They just said, let's keep all these massively regressive taxes that we currently have, and let's add this new extra tax. And by the way, we're going to market this as a tax for the wealthy, but what's going to happen, in my opinion, is if the House approves it and the governor signs it, and whether it can go to referendum or not, if it gets challenged in the state Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court currently has shown itself to be very tax friendly. And if they uphold it, then eventually all of the exemptions will eventually be lowered that are currently in the bill, and the thresholds will be reduced to the point where we have a tax that doesn't go after the ultra rich. It goes after everybody. And that's my concern with this tax.
And let's take our break here now, and when we come back, we'll talk about the vote last weekend on a measure allowing overtime for farm workers moving forward. And it appears to have the support of agriculture, and I'll get your take on that when we come back. Senator Brad Hawkins, our guest on the agenda today. Back in a moment.
Welcome back to The Agenda on News Radio 560 KPQ. With Dave Bernstein.
And our guest today for the full hour, Senator Brad Hawkins. We're going to get an update on some of the bills that he has been involved with, including promoting hydrogen-powered vehicles, a sign of the future, our utility wildfire bill as well, some help for tow truck operators, and want to talk about the school bond threshold proposal as well, and also looking at the school calendar. Lots to talk about, so I'm glad we have the whole hour. But Senator Hawkins, last week there was a vote in the Senate, or this past weekend, that would allow overtime for farm workers that passed in the Senate, and I think it's now headed to the House. This stems from, I understand, a court decision that was focused on the dairy decision last fall. And so what can you tell us about that? How did you vote on this?
Well, that's right, Dave. So that particular is another state Supreme Court decision related to agricultural overtime. Currently, that state Supreme Court decision just affected the dairy farmers, but many of the agricultural groups and the orchardists in North Central Washington believe that there's a potential that that could affect us as well. So this particular bill basically took an examination of the overtime exemption for farm workers, which is currently in state law, and tried to phase in overtime beginning in January 2022. So basically, the bill as it passed the Senate said if you have over 55 hours of work per week, then you have to pay overtime at that point, and then each year it changes. So for example, start at 55 hours, goes down to 48 hours in January of 2023. And then by January of 2024, if you have farm workers that work above 40 hours, then that's where the overtime would kick in. So it's kind of a phased approach, and many of the agricultural stakeholders kind of feel like, well, maybe we need to get in front of where the state Supreme Court could be. I voted against the bill. There were a number of us Republicans that did so, even though the bill was sponsored by my Senate colleague out of Yakima, Curtis King. The bill actually kind of came to us at the very end, just before the cutoff for Senate bills to pass the Senate. And frankly, we didn't have a lot of time to talk about it or consider it. And I felt, having to make a decision probably within about 30 minutes of first learning about this proposal to the time we actually took the Senate vote, I just didn't feel comfortable supporting it. I felt like perhaps if this arrangement was to be made, some of the orchardists in our area, like the Stemmelts, the Avils, the McDougals, some of those folks could be able to absorb some of the overtime increases, whereas some of the smaller orchardists and farmers in Central Washington might not be in a position to do that. But it was described to me as a work-in-progress bill, which means they knew it wasn't perfect. They wanted to keep the bill alive, send it over to the House before the bill died off due to the cutoff date, and then let the House work some improvements to the bill. So if the bill changes in the House, which we suspect it will, I will have a chance to vote up or down for final approval in the Senate. And interesting that two of our House members, Representatives Gaynor and Steele, are actually orchardists, because Representative Gaynor is a longtime pear orchardist, and Representative Steele's family has an orchard in the Manson area. And so I really would be interested to see what their votes would be, because they do kind of represent those smaller farmers that I'm kind of interested in protecting. And if they're comfortable with it, I likely will be comfortable with it too. So we'll see what happens to that bill as it goes forward. Certainly some security and something put in place in statute, so would be helpful for the orchardists, so I can see kind of why they want to do it. Because at this point, with the state Supreme Court, you know, you're really rolling the dice. And a lot of the groups, farm workers and other groups, have been going to the state Supreme Court rather than going to the legislature to try to get resolution on their issue.
Yeah, the Seattle Times reported the Washington State Tree Fruit Association said that agriculture employers were moved to support the bill because they feared losing future litigation and possibly could have to face some huge retroactive overtime payments. So it was kind of like this might help fend that off in the future. All right. Let's talk about a couple of things that you've been involved with. First off, your bill with promoting hydrogen-powered vehicles has passed unanimously in the Senate. What are the prospects over in the House? What are you hearing?
Well, I hope they're good. We actually had three different committees that I had to navigate through over here in the Senate before it passed unanimously. So it had a lot of love over here. Perhaps too much, and I was just concerned every step of the way, but now it's advanced over to the House of Representatives, and just yesterday morning, we had a hearing before the House Finance Committee, and it went really well. The Douglas County Public Utility District General Manager, Gary Ivory, was one of the stakeholders who testified, as well as representatives from Toyota and the Hydrogen Alliance groups and others. And I do believe it'll be positive. I think North Central Washington is really well positioned to not only lead the state, but potentially the West Coast and perhaps the entire United States on this renewable hydrogen opportunity, because the bill I passed a couple of years ago provided PUDs the opportunity to produce and distribute renewable hydrogen, which is a product that can be used for many industrial purposes, but also as a clean transportation fuel. And Douglas PUD just last week broke ground on their renewable hydrogen production facility outside East Wenatchee. So they'll be producing this hydrogen here by year's end, and hopefully we'll have in place tax policy in our state that affords the hydrogen fuel cell electric vehicles the same incentives as what the state has long provided to its battery electric vehicles. Both vehicles produce zero greenhouse gas emissions, so I think it's important to have tax parity. If I can get the bill out of the Finance Committee, hopefully we'll take it to the House floor, and later on the governor will sign it. Hopefully I can do all that in the next few weeks.
There is a Senate Bill 5347 that has passed in the Senate Budget Committee, and this is an education bill that you've sponsored that takes a look at the school calendar. And we're having a lot of problems with, I think we probably maybe have a lot of problems with kids kind of forgetting things in a normal situation, but you had floated this idea about what if we kind of if I'm recalling your bill, found some districts interested in looking at a experimental or a year-round project, and so if this were to pass, how would this work?
Well, it's purely voluntary, and we have almost 300 school districts in the state of Washington, 295 to be exact. And so what my bill proposes is let's offer a pilot program, totally voluntary, for up to 20 school districts, some larger, some mid-sized, some smaller, to pilot this program where they take the existing 180 state-funded school days and spread those out over a longer period. So rather than squeezing them all into 9 months and having a few months off, and then having not only to deal with the learning loss, but having to reteach things every September, why not spread those 180 days out a little bit longer, maybe over 11 months, maybe 10 and a half. So I still support a summer break. Maybe it could be 4 to 6 weeks instead of 10 to 12 weeks. And maybe there wouldn't be the stopping and restarting that's so inefficient into our system. So the way the bill would work is there'd be a one-year planning process for community outreach and discussion with employee groups. Then there'd be a two-year program for the school districts to participate. And for the school districts that do participate, they'd receive a modest financial incentive to do so. And then at the end of that 3 years, basically, the one-year planning and the two-year participation, then OSPI, the State Superintendent of Public Instruction, would report back to the legislature on data, on academic gains, and other things so that we could see as a state, does it make sense to try to incentivize something like this for more school districts and maybe get to a point where we could potentially reform our school calendar? Because I do know that if we were to design the school calendar today, I don't think any of us would ever design it the way that almost every school district is doing it. It's very inefficient for the taxpayer investment, and it's not good for students' long-term academic progress. And surprising, Dave, this is something that most people just don't even think about, but I've crunched the numbers, I've looked at the data, the amount of per student costs in Washington State per each and every student, when you combine the state dollars and the local levy dollars, not including the federal dollars, it's almost $15,000 per student just this year. And so if you think about it, we're, as taxpayers, we're investing in the system, and we shouldn't be investing into an inefficient system. You know, that's not good for us as taxpayers. So I'd like to, as we prepare to pull out of this pandemic, I'd like to encourage my colleagues and school districts to think big, think differently, try to bring some transformational changes into the system, and that's really what this bill is attempting to do.
Okay. Prospects to get a full vote. That's passed at the budget committee, but where do you think it's headed for a full Senate vote?
Well, I have four prime-sponsored bills this year, and three of my four bills are in the House of Representatives before those committees. The fourth bill has been approved by two Senate committees, the Education Committee and the Senate Budget Committee, and this bill, this particular bill, is positioned on the Senate floor calendar and could get a vote. I'm hopeful it will, but change is difficult, and I don't know if everybody's willing to take that step with me, but my thought is if we can't do it now, after this pandemic, thinking about all the learning loss from our students with COVID, with the less than ideal remote learning and the lack of in-person, in-building instruction that all throughout our state, if we can't do it now, then we're going to deal with annual summer learning loss all over again, all the inefficient reteaching every September, the stopping and starting for staff. It just doesn't make sense to me. And if we can't do it now, as we prepare to pull out of this pandemic, I'll actually be very discouraged, because when will we ever be able to?
Yeah, now's the time when it's first and foremost in people's minds. Let's move quickly on these next two before we hit a break. Want to ask about the utility wildfire bill that's been approved in the Senate, and also the help for tow truck operators, which I know Randy's Towing, their owner has been very involved with the Tow Truck Operators Association for a number of years. And so you've got some bills there. Let's, get us up to date again on the utility wildfire bill around here. That's very important.
Yeah, very important. You know, we have not only a four different public utility districts in the 12th district, but we also have a history of unfortunate catastrophic wildfire. So I'm really thankful to be working with DNR and partnering with Chelan PD. Steve Wright has done an excellent job. He's testified every step along the way. We have two different committees for this bill in the Senate. We just had a hearing on the bill before the House Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee. I'm hopeful that the bill will get approved next week. The chair of the committee says he's going to bring it up for a vote. And if the next step could potentially be the full House approval. So I'm excited about that.
What does it do?
Basically, what it does is it helps implement a set of recommendations that a utility wildfire task force kind of developed but haven't yet been implemented. It also puts in place some ongoing communication opportunities, not only with the electric utilities and DNR, but also between DNR, the electric utilities, and the policymakers at the legislature, with some ongoing reporting and communication processes. So I think it's all very important, especially when we consider what has happened down in California recently, where some of the largest electric utilities actually were bankrupted by the liabilities that were placed upon them in California. We certainly don't want that here. We don't want catastrophic wildfires. Utility lines can spark wildfires. So coming up with good protocols to remove danger trees and good communication processes, all those things are very important. So if we can get in front of this a little bit with our electric utilities and DNR, that's a very, very good thing and could save the state hundreds of millions of dollars and loss of life. So it's very important. The other bill, the tow truck operator bill, is a bill that Randy Houston brought an idea to me. He's basically saying, hey, we get dispatched by state patrol, we get called out by local law enforcement, we're asked to remove some of these vehicles that are blocking the roadway, holding up traffic, or stuck in a creek. So we have to pay my crew to do that. Sometimes I hire subcontractors, and they are putting out a lot of money to do this important work, and sometimes they don't get paid, because then they have to try to collect from the drivers who were negligent or collect from the insurance companies, and the insurance companies say, well, our policy doesn't cover that type of a tow truck expense. And so basically, this bill would give the tow truck operators an opportunity to collect from people who are negligent, who have been called out by the state patrol or other local law enforcement. So my thought is these folks are doing important work. We certainly don't want them refusing to do the work, and we don't want them vehicle profiling. Could you imagine if Randy's towing rolled up and said, oh, okay, that's a 2020 Cadillac Escalade. I will haul that away. Let me just hook up and spend a couple hours and get this done. Or if they show up and say, oh, that's a 1987 Ford Taurus sedan. You know, I got a lot of calls. I don't know if I'm going to get paid for this one. I got to go. You know, so we need the tow truck operators doing the work. And if they do the work, they should be paid. They shouldn't be stuck with the bill.
Yeah.
So my bill tries to remedy that.
Yeah. And I think they're on kind of a rotating call. If you don't specify, then whoever's up next kind of has to take the call. So
or in some areas, you're the only person. Yeah.
All right. Let's take another break here. We've got a lot more ground to cover. We're talking with State Senator Brad Hawkins. Want to ask about for a gentleman I spoke with yesterday, who's very curious about prospects for the gas tax hikes that we've been hearing about. 1:44 now on the agenda. We come back.
Welcome back to The Agenda on News Radio 560 KPQ with Dave Bernstein.
And we're talking with State Senator Brad Hawkins the full hour today and a legislative update. We have him on from time to time here during the session. And we're a little over halfway. Let's get an update on what you know about gas taxes. What are you hearing out of the Senate so far? And maybe from Keith and Mike from any discussions you've heard from them over in the House.
Yeah, so we've had some different proposals. The way our transportation system works in terms of funding is we have a two-year transportation budget. That funds the Department of Licensing, the State Patrol. It also funds WASDOT employees and other things. But also what the two-year transportation budget does is it approves appropriations in that biennium for major transportation projects that were approved in a different transportation package, like a gas tax package. The most recent gas tax revenue package was approved in 2015, and there have been some approvals to do more projects. And when we do more projects, we have to have the corresponding revenue, the new revenues to pay for them. But we've tried to get a little bit beyond the gas tax. I've never personally voted for a gas tax, but with the popularity of more fuel-efficient vehicles and electric vehicles, even though the electric vehicles are charged a fee, there is still reduced revenue coming in from gas tax. So when we do need to generate revenue for a project, the proposals have come in significantly higher, anywhere from, say, extra 6 cents per gallon of a gas tax to upwards of 18 cents per gallon. Currently, the state has a 49 cents per gallon gas tax. Some of that goes towards repaying the bonds. Some of it goes to cities and counties. Others go to, the portion of it goes to operation and maintenance. And operation and, or preservation and maintenance of our existing system is very important. But whether it's an 18 cent per gallon increase in gas tax or it's a 6 cent increase in gas tax plus a carbon fee plus extra expanded electric vehicle fees, some way or another, there needs to be extra revenue generated to pay for new projects if we want them. Some of the new projects, for example, that have been identified in our area is that Confluence Parkway Bridge, the second bridge across the Wenatchee River, and the Confluence Parkway road into Old Station. But that itself, for example, Dave, is a $130 million project. So it's just a matter of, we want a high-functioning transportation system. Do we want to pay for it? And those are the tough decisions that we're going to need to make in the coming years as a community, if we're going to be paying an extra gas tax. Right now, I just don't think this is the session when it's going to happen.
There's also a proposal to change what the voters the threshold, I guess, to pass a school bond. And right now, to pass a levy, it's 50% plus one, but it's much higher for school bonds. That could change?
Yeah, quite possibly. I mean, the theme of this session might be hold on to your pocketbook, because whether it's a capital gains income tax or what people are proposing with gas tax or even school levy authorization. So the way I like to explain it is school levies are for learning. They support, they're short-term taxes that support the ongoing operations of a school district. The school bonds are for buildings, and when you approve a bond, like you do a levy, it's a vote of the local jurisdiction, and it impacts your property taxes. Right now, the school bonds are at a 60% threshold for voter approval. I was on the school board at Eastmont when we passed the most recent bond. We did it on the first try. It was during the recession, but it renovated the Eastmont High School, and I think a Grant Elementary and Sterling Middle School, but we were successful at doing that. I mean, it is difficult, but you can do it if you put forward reasonable requests of the voters. Well, some of the tax advocates and school advocates in Olympia want to make it easier for school districts to pass those bonds and want to lower the threshold to 50% to a simple majority, just like levies. But I didn't support that proposal. It did get voted out of the Education Committee in the Senate that I serve on. But I think the school levies and the school bonds are two totally different tax votes. The school levies, as I mentioned, those are short-term impacts authorized every few years. But the school bonds, on the other hand, those are much longer-term tax votes that, once they're approved, are implemented for a community for 20 to 25 years, to pay back those bonds. And so I think there's a real issue of what I call intergenerational equity when it comes to lowering the threshold for those. And I think it is an important protection for the taxpayer to have the school bonds at the current 60%. I don't know if that'll come before the full Senate for a vote, but I think it's possible that either this year or in future years they're going to try to do that. And the reality is some school districts do come up a little bit short, but it's not as if it's just a result of a couple percentage points on the vote. It's usually other issues related to maybe the school district asked for a little too much. Maybe they wanted to build a whole new building rather than make some renovations to existing ones. Maybe they tried for a district office or something like that. So there's always some other reason, I think, besides just the simple majority vote that they're talking about. So watch for that and hold on to your wallet, too.
Okay, we only have about 2 minutes left. I think we're about to get another revenue forecast coming, and that means we should be getting close to getting the three different budgets to come out. So give us a little time frame on that and what you expect we might hear with this forecast, revenue forecast.
Yeah, hopefully positive on the revenue forecast as our economy continues to recover. The three budgets will be released, the proposals anyway, later this month. So the way that works is you have a House and a Senate, and you have three budgets, the operating, the transportation, and the capital. So each respective chamber, House and Senate, will be unveiling their proposals for each of those three budgets. And then ultimately, we need to agree on the same budget, and the governor's office and the governor need to sign off on that. So if we can all figure out a way to find an agreement over the next several weeks, we'll be able to adjourn the session on schedule. And if people have any questions as we go on these budgets, on transportation or other issues, I really encourage them to contact my office, Dave. My website is senatorbradhawkins.org, and people can always reach out to me that way for more information.
All right. We appreciate the legislative update today. Thanks for joining us.
Yes. Thanks so much, Dave. It was good to have a good long conversation with you, and thanks for the opportunity to be on the agenda.
All right. Senator Brad Hawkins joining us today. News Radio 560 KPQ.